Well, it is indeed an honor to be asked to come and to speak and to teach, and especially on something that's a little new, or something that you don't normally hear people talk about a lot is the integration of our age groups and helping each other. If you look at Matthew 28, 19 and 20, Jesus says, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all the things that I've commanded you." A basic understanding of Christianity is that we're supposed to teach others to teach others to teach others. And in fact, when I talk to my denominational friends or folks who want to understand the nature of the church, I say it's pretty much just a linear passage. If you find somebody who's doing something religiously, I don't care what it is, if he learned that practice from a disciple who learned it from a disciple who learned it from a disciple who learned it from the writings of an apostle who learned it from the Messiah, if you've got a direct line from what you're doing all the way back to the beginning, it's probably a pretty sound religious practice. But if you can't trace your religious beliefs or religious practice or your religious teachings in a linear fashion back to the New Testament, somebody's made a curve somewhere. And you know, I think we would understand that part of what we do as mature Christians is to evangelize and disciple. But I think sometimes we don't think about that one of the very obvious discipleship venues is our ability to teach our own children. Our ability to teach young people in our community. I remember as a little boy that there was a gentleman who lived in Lineville, Alabama. His name was John Brenton Rice. And for whatever reason, I went to church when I visited my grandparents where he went to church. And he asked me would I like to spend one day a week with him at a cabinet shop in Anniston, Alabama. My mom would pack me a lunch and he'd come pick me up on Thursday mornings. And at about 13 or 14 years old, I learned to build cabinets. I learned to operate some really interesting tools. Now, there's an old boy that worked in the cabinet shop who would thought it was funny to send you on errands, go find the nail stretcher or other things like that. But once you get past that kind of stuff, he just took to, and it wasn't necessarily anything he was teaching me about church, but he's one of the stronger influences in my life. That this older gentleman said, "I've got a skill set that a kid your age is never going to learn to grow up and do." And I spent a lot of time in a cabinet shop. I do a little bit of woodworking. Most of the stuff I build is in trees off the ground at my ropes course. But, you know, when I found out that this skill set and the confidence I had around some of these tools came from this older gentleman who, for whatever reason, invested a handful of Thursdays one summer. That's invaluable stuff in my life. I wonder what would happen if, as part of what you do for this congregation, you grabbed a young mom and said, "I teach you to can if you'd like to learn that. I teach you to quilt if you'd like to learn that." There is a skill set in this room that will perish in the next generation. Things that people don't know how to do. There's very few people who can churn butter. There are very few people who know how to knit or sew or smock. And it gets trendy, and you find it on Pinterest. If I ever find the guy who invented Pinterest, you will not find his body. Because he created a lot of busy work for me, having those people be able to put that. I have my own Pinterest page. My daughter created it. "Dad, these are your projects." I didn't sign up for that. But I have this list of stuff. But there's so many things you could do simply teaching people the things that you know. And as you did that, you build a bond and strengthen your relationship and your influence as a mature Christian. Look what Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 2 Timothy chapter 2. "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." Who do you think he had in mind when he tells Timothy, "Take this information I'm giving you and give it to somebody else"? You think he was talking about giving it to people his own age or younger men? You know, we think about Timothy being a young man, and really you need to understand he's probably in his 30s. He's probably in our society, you know, approaching that early adulthood, maybe even wiggling his toes into middle age. And Paul's telling this young man, I've been your mentor, and you find somebody else to mentor. If you teach a Bible class and you're not inviting some younger person to sit in the class and watch you teach, model the way you teach, you're missing an opportunity to help somebody grow, and you're taking an opportunity away from someone. And I'd like for you just to, in your mind, think about, what can I do to help connect with people, and what can I share with them from my age, my wisdom, my experience? You know, what is a crisis for some people is not a crisis for other folks if you've got a lot of time on the ground. You know, I've been working with teenagers since 1980. And so when somebody comes in and they're a first-time parent, it's the first time they've ever had a teenager in their house, and there's this big crisis. It's the first time they've ever gone through it. It's probably the 100th time I've seen it. And it's not a big deal. One of the little girls in the fellowship hall had a meltdown. She needed her third or fourth brownie. And Mom had determined, you've had all the brownies you need. And of course, I walked by and asked what was going on, and I had the brownie discussion. I'm in grandparent mode. I don't think that fourth brownie would have killed anybody or created a diabetic coma. So I said, I'm going to disengage and walk away. I'm a little above my pay grade here. I'd have given the beautiful little girl a brownie myself. But I'm in grandparent mode. I'm learning to, you know. But what about some of the things that people think are crises with their children that you've lived through and gone through? How much of that wisdom could you share? Now, the reason we want to share that wisdom is because our goal in the church is to create a flow that our children go from dependence to independence. This is a little chart I like to use. It's an inverse proportionate chart. You notice that when this side is thick, this part is thin. When that side is thin, that part is thick. That means as one side changes, the other side is affected. And I like to talk about it from the idea that this is dependence and that is independence. And when you have a lot of dependence, you have very little independence. And as your independence increases, your dependence decreases. Everybody on the same page there? When we talk about children, when you're born, all the way through your adulthood, when children come into the world, they are 100% dependent. That little infant can't do anything. It can't roll over. It can't make decisions. It has zero independence. It can't turn over unless you use an egg flipper. It doesn't control what goes in. It doesn't control what comes out. Watch these little girls bring those babies to church with those head tourniquets on them. They've decided that little baby needs to wear a garter around its head with a flower on it bigger than its head. And that poor sweet little thing can't get it off because she doesn't have the fine motor control to do it. And she doesn't get to make any of those choices. Wait till she turns about 7. Mama, I don't like that. Mama, I won't wear that. I had a little boy in my practice. A neat little story. Young lady came into the practice, and she looked to be in her early 20s. Beautiful young lady, just a soft, beautiful eyes, little blonde. She came in with these two little boys. She said, these are my stepchildren. And I said, well, tell me about the difficulties. And she said, well, their father, his wife, had some kind of mental issue and just misbehaved badly and ended up in a scriptural divorce. Well, this little boy was in her Bible class on Wednesday nights. He'd come into her Bible class and say, hey, every Wednesday night, me and my dad go eat ice cream. You ought to go with us. And he recruited this lady to go eat ice cream. Well, she ended up marrying his dad. But she said, I didn't realize what I was signing up for. That little boy, his daddy works a ranch there in Alabama right at the foot of Fort Bluff, and he thinks that he's a cowboy. He thinks if it can be rode, he can ride it. If it can be roped, he can rope it. He will not wear anything on his feet but boots, and will not wear a pair of pants that doesn't accept a belt. No elastic for this kid. Now, this is a young lady who has no parenting experience. She's got instant mom. She married this guy and got this little kid. She's telling me about this little boy. She said he got in trouble with his brother, and we asked him to apologize. He said, I can't. She said, why can't you apologize? He said, I'm a cowboy. And cowboys are mean. And mean people don't apologize. And so now there she is. He's gone from this idea where he has no independence to being right in here where he says, you know what, I can decide whether I apologize or not. And as our children move through that, it creates crises in families. It creates crises. And what we're trying to do is model some behaviors so that as the adults in the building find somebody, either a young adult, a young family, or even a teenager or a child that you can have some influence with and that you can help move all the way from dependence to independence. Now, I've included in this part of the chart, just to, that by the time they're adults, they should be 100% independent and not rely or require anything from us. And we also would like that to be a place where they have spiritual independence, where their spiritual development, their spiritual growth, and their spiritual understanding comes from within themselves. They don't have to rely on what Brother Bob says or what Brother Lonnie says or what Brother John says, but they can pick up their Bibles and know what God says. And that's part of you mentoring as a Bible student. You know, think about how many years you've got in studying the Bible and reading the Bible and what you could share with a young family or a young person just from your life experience and just from your qualifications of being able to teach folks. Now, the other part of this thing is that if you look at the middle of this chart, and I'm going to clean that up so there's no words in it, the top part of this chart and the bottom part of the chart for all practical purposes are the same. That's a teenager. The teenagers in your congregation have as much dependence as they do independence. They're child-adult and adult-child. If that 16-year-old boy comes in, he's got his driver's license, he has his own job, and he wants his own money so he can buy video games. That's kind of that mixed message kind of thing. Well, when you get parents who are dealing with these kind of folks right here, you know, sometimes that's a mind-altering experience. I argue sometimes that when God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, that Isaac was not a teenager, because it wouldn't have been any big deal for Abraham to kill him. He'd have been kill that, sure, Lord, done. You know, but I think he was either younger or quite a bit older, but it wouldn't have been hard to kill a teenager if you've been around them much. But when you deal with people who are going through that for the first time or the only time, they could rely on your experience and your patience and your wisdom. Isn't it amazing what used to seem like a crisis to you when you were in your 30s is not a crisis to you when you're in your 50s or your 60s? Some of the things that we thought was really, really important as you've matured doesn't seem to be that important anymore. I wonder what would happen if we could share that wisdom with some folks. I wonder what, you know, when we talk about values with our families. I like to do this little chart, and I didn't bring it. But, you know, if you look at your life and you organize your values, you have things that are important at the top, things that are not important at the bottom. Things that are urgent over here, things that are not urgent over there, so that you get this quadrant. You have things that are urgent and important. Do you remember what things used to seem urgent and important when you were 27? And now the things that occupy your urgent and important thing when you're not 27? Isn't it interesting how your values change? You know, what happens with our younger generation is, and this is the way I do it, things that are urgent and important have immediate consequences. If you don't do something, something will happen. Things that are important but not urgent have delayed consequences. If you don't put away money for retirement, if you don't eat properly, if you don't you can eat anything you want to until you're 45. You can eat without consequence until you're about 45. You get north of 45, you either better be on a treadmill or say no to the donuts, one or the other. You got some choices to make. Then you have things that are urgent but not important. And then you have things that are not important and not urgent. I think everybody in this room would probably 90% agree about what we think is urgent and important in life. And I think most of us would agree with what's not urgent and what's not important. Where our young families, the folks that are younger than you, lose their priorities is they take the things that are urgent but not important and let them take the place of things that are important but not urgent. And that's where we lose the battle, because they think their kids have to play 9 sports and be in every club and attend all the things. And a person with your experience and your wisdom might say, you know what, you probably have more influence on your children if you spent more time with them and they spent less time with the coach. We think we've got to provide certain things for our children when we're a certain age. I told my daughter, you know, we took a big leap of faith and I went into private practice. I went from having a steady salary and a steady income and guaranteed stuff to, I'm going to open this little office and folks are either going to come or they're not going to come. And we tried to make a determination that we would own the business wouldn't own us. And I told my daughter, and I'm glad she made a good choice, because I don't know what would have done if she had said the other thing, but I said, you can drive a used Toyota, and I'll be at all your volleyball games. Or you can drive a Corvette, and you won't ever see me. Which one would you like to do? And I was thankful that she was intuitive enough to say, Dad, I'd rather have a used car and you be there than me have this nice fancy car and you not be there. Of course, I wasn't really going to not be there, and she wasn't going to drive a Corvette. But I wanted her to understand that everything you say yes to is something else you say no to, and some of the things you say no to is not going to cause the world to end. But we get this idea that it's urgent. We've got to have a 3-car garage and have a boat in one of those bays. We've got to have this size house, or we've got to have this brand name. And it's really urgent what the world says, but it's really not that important. And we take those things that are urgent but not important, and we let them supersede the things that are very, very important, but nobody's calling us to task about them. You know, you don't know whether I prayed this morning or not when I got up. You don't know whether I worked out this morning when I got up. Those things won't catch up to me for a long, long time, but they eventually will catch up. So when we start helping people reach this place, you know, when your children are talking about being dependent and independent, you say, you know, some of the things that are a crisis for a teenager aren't going to be a crisis over here. And don't let these younger parents get sucked into the idea that these crisis of the teenagers should rule your world. And I'm afraid we lose that connection. One of the problems is that we lost that connection because we don't live in extended families anymore. You probably can remember when, you know, the old home place was right here, and then the children had property here, and then the next generation had property here, and families were connected. When we started disconnecting from families, the major source of influence on children became other children. And you're at school, and you've got this reprobate, rebel kid who's a smart aleck to a coach or a smart aleck to a teacher. He looks pretty cool. He kind of has this swag and kind of has this savvy. But you put that same kid, and he's disrespectful to his father, who happens to be your favorite uncle. It doesn't sound that cool anymore, does it? But when we've isolated the children from stable adults, and they're just children around children, and young adults around young adults, and middle marriage around middle marriage, and senior citizen around senior, we live in this microcosm, and we kind of define the world according to ourselves. And that's a bad place to be. I read a study, I think it was in Kenya. I may not have the place right, but they had a real problem with the overpopulation of the elephants. And the elephants were eating a lot of crops and a lot of food. And so, you know, the obvious thing is you want less stuff to eat, kill the bigger elephants. So they went in, they thinned this herd, and they took out these big bull elephants out of this herd. Well, in about 5 to 7 years, the adolescent male elephants were out of control. They were wrecking fences, wrecking houses. They were being sexually aggressive toward the mature females of the group. And they couldn't understand this aberrant behavior from these young male elephants. And so the Kenyan forestry division went out and imported 3 big multi-ton bull elephants back to this pride of elephants. And guess what happened to those young bulls? They got snatched in them by this big bull elephant. Said, this is not the way you act. Well, how many times have we taken the bull elephants away from the teenagers? And I think young, vibrant, charismatic, energetic youth ministers do a good job. And I was one of those guys. I was an 18-year-old youth minister. I was a 17-year-old single youth minister. You know, I was a 21-year-old youth minister with a 19-year-old wife who was as beautiful as a model and had some cool factor with the kids. But, you know, I wasn't very mature. In fact, when Paul tells Timothy, don't let anybody despise you because of your age, but be an example of the believers in word and spirit and conversation and charity and faith and purity, he's telling Timothy, if you're young, you need to act older than you are so people won't despise you. And although I think your youth ministry system is good and you've got a lot of maturity in that young man, he's still a very young man and could use your assistance. What would happen if he said, hey, we're going to take the kids to camp, and some of you guys said, hey, I'd like to go with you. and show them that you can have a good time at camp without having to play softball. You're not supposed to play ultimate frisbee at camp at your age. Yeah. But what would happen if we could expose those young people to some different models of behavior that's not just about their peer group or not just about the things society worships? Does that make sense? Now, in order to help with our young people, they talk about from dependence to independence and these kind of things. What we want to do, I think I'm backing this thing up for some reason. We want to talk about how to get out of that. You want to expose our young people to what Stephen Glenn calls the significant seven. And this is where we need your help in the congregation. Last night we talked about three things: attention, belonging, and support. Well, as you think about what you're doing in the lives of the young families or even in the younger children, as you interact with them, keep these in the back of your mind. And by the way, if anything I say on these charts you want a copy of, it's on the hard drive back there. You can ask the sound booth guys, hey, give me a printout of those handouts, and that's available to you. That's not a problem with me. The significant seven involves three perceptions, and it also involves four skills. The three perceptions: number one, I'm capable. That's simply you helping young people learn that there's something they can do. We had a little guy riding the chair buggy out there when we were cleaning up the fellowship hall. And instead of telling him to get out of the way, somebody said, hey, help me carry this chair. Hey, help me push this thing. And all of a sudden, this little guy who was in the way was helping. The next time we start to take down or put up the fellowship hall and he's here, guess what you think he'll do? Because what? He's understood there's something I can do with the church. Now, a lot of times it's easier to do it by yourself and not be involved with kids. You know the rule about working with teenagers, right? If you have a teenage boy working with you, you have a teenage boy. If you have two teenage boys, you have half a boy. If you have three teenage boys, you got a boy at all. That's gone. That's out the window. But sometimes it's about, I don't really need the help as much as they need to help me. I got my daughter to help me change the oil in the car, to hold some boards while I sawed some things, to do some things. And she learned, you know, before she was allowed to drive, she had to be able to change the oil and change a tire. You know how many tires she changed in college for boys? I'd have shot myself in the head before I let a four foot ten blonde girl change a tire on my car. But her and her little friend Jordan, and I took her to the oil place, and we ran the car through the oil change place, and I wrote him a check, and I stuck that receipt in her lap. I said, every time you change the oil in your driveway, you make this much money. Every time you run it through here, you spend this much money, it's your money. She changed her oil quite a bit during high school, so she'd have that spending money. When she got to school, she knew how to change oil. She knew how to change other people's oil. And basically, we taught her, there's some things that you can do. You are capable. Of course, I'm a dad. I taught her to shoot. She's ambidextrous, can shoot right-handed or left-handed. I made her learn 12 self-defense moves before she was allowed to date. Now, that's just a personal thing with me. Nothing says no like a dislocated shoulder. I said, you know, you can't date till you're 16, but when you get 16, you can't go till you can demonstrate an arm bar, a knee bar, a couple of chokes, and a couple of good throws. And she feels pretty confident. She's maybe too confident for a person who's 4'10", but I don't worry about her too much because she has this sense of, I'm capable. And you can teach that to children by asking them for their help, even if you really don't need it, understanding that they need to help you. And a lot of times there's things you can teach them too. And you know, you may be thinking there's nothing they want to learn. You might be surprised what a child or a young family would be willing or able to learn from you. And if you took the time to talk with them about what you know. My friend Derek, his dad is a retired NASA scientist. He's responsible for one of the Apollo missions and part of the space lab thing. And we've got this big space and rocket center in Huntsville, and the new Davison Flight Center. They've got the Saturn V rocket on its side, and it's opened up in sections. And Max will go down there and just kind of walk around. He's an old Nebraska boy, still has his Nebraska accent, but he's lived in Huntsville since the days of the rocket program. And he goes, hangs out at the Space and Rocket Center. And somebody will read something on a chart and say something out loud, and Max will go, well, that's not really how that worked. And all of a sudden, you've got this toddly old gentleman who built the thing that's in the museum. You know how much fun he is to spend time with at the Space and Rocket Museum? Well, that's pretty amazing stuff. There's a rappelling device known as the rappel rack. It's a piece of extruded aluminum with bars on it. And it's designed to be used when you rappel a distance greater than 300 feet. There's some mathematics and some physics that takes place when you're rappelling. You have weight of the rope that slows you down. And as you get closer to the bottom, you have less rope below you, so you're overcoming friction and losing resistance at the same time, and you can accelerate at a geometric rate. I turned a pair of gloves into a glass, figuring that out for myself. I was eating dinner with a bunch of guys, had done a team building for some groups out of NASA, and got to talking about rappelling, and I said, well, I understand that the rappel rack was invented in Huntsville, Alabama, some guy at the arsenal. I said, I'd sure like to shake that man's hand. The guy across the table stuck his hand out. I'm sitting at the table with the inventor of the rappel rack. Changed the conversation because I was talking about all the things I knew about vertical stuff and decided I should listen a little bit. And you might be surprised that young people don't see you as full of wisdom. It's their fault, not yours, but if you just took the time to share that with them, take a young couple out to dinner, take a young couple out after church on Sunday, invite them to come look at your library, invite them, you know, you might just put up a bulletin board, I'm going to teach this, would you like to learn it? You might be surprised the friendships you'd build from young and old alike. So we teach them I'm capable. Second thing that we have to teach them is I am significant. Significance comes from the idea that there's nobody in the church who's not important. And I'm afraid sometimes we teach that, if you're not an elder or a song leader or a youth minister or something, that you don't have significance. And part of your job is to find people and fill them with a sense of significance. I remember as a little boy, there was a gentleman at our church named Ed Strickland. And Brother Ed was about my size that I am now, maybe a little wider and a little thinner. And for whatever reason, he took an interest in me. And at every church service, he was going to talk to me. He would find me and ask me about my week. He'd find me and ask me what that girl's name was that I was sitting behind church that Sunday. Even to the point that he said, you know, I really wish you'd go up into the valley, Shinbone Valley, if you've ever heard of the Shinbone Valley in Alabama. He said, I wish you'd go over to Shinbone and let them hear you preach. I was 14 at the time. I said, Brother Ed, I'd love to go over there, but I can't drive. He said, I'll drive you. And the first gospel meeting I ever did, we drove back and forth in his old white pickup truck. And this man was two or maybe three times my age. And we built a vast friendship, and I learned a lot from him. I'd have never taken the time to get to know him had he not taken the time to get to know me. And he taught me I was significant. I knew that if nobody else in that building thought I was important, Brother Ed Strickland did. I'd come home from college, and he was one of the stops I'd make to go sit on his porch and talk to him. Lots of good memories from somebody who invested time in me. Brother Ed did, Brother John Brenton Rice did, and several guys that served as my mentors. And if you were to mentor someone, you'd be teaching them that they're significant. And then the third thing is that we need to pass on this idea that I can influence what happens to me. People need to learn that their choices affect their outcomes. And a lot of times I'm afraid that we don't give enough reality therapy to folks. You know, somebody says, I don't feel connected to the church. Well, how many people have you had in your house this year? How many people's houses have you been to this year? How many events did you attend other than worship? And I think sometimes your gentle wisdom could tell folks, you know, in order to be friendly, in order to have friends, you got to be friendly. In order to be connected to somebody. It's interesting to me that if you think it's important for somebody to come visit you in the hospital, you should probably be going and visiting people in the hospital. But a lot of times people don't realize that their choices have consequences. And as older people and more mature people who have a different view of the world, you might can help teach people that you're making choices. And a lot of times we make choices and then we don't like the consequences, especially what we do with our time or what we don't do with our time. You know, I think a lot of times it would be good advice for an older gentleman or an older lady to sit down and say, you know, your kids really don't need more stuff. They need more time with you. talk to somebody about the significant memories they have. And it won't be a trip to Destin. It won't be the trip to Disney Place. I get world and land mixed up, so I just call it Disney Place. You know, the things that are significant are, hey, we sat on the porch and watched the sun go down. Things that you don't even know kids are registering or what kids register. You talk to somebody about, you know, how you really looked at what the valuable time was. And people of your generation can say, you know, if you're teaching your kids that it's important to go, go, go and do, rather than just be. We make choices about what we do in our younger years and they affect us in our older years. And it may be that you could share some of that wisdom. But everything in life you say yes to is something else in life you say no to. That's a law of the universe. And help young people model what they're saying yes to and what they're saying no to. Along with the significant seven, you have four skills. And this is really where your wisdom and your knowledge comes in. And this is how we model helping young people mature spiritually. The four skills, the first one we call intrapersonal skills. The second one is interpersonal skills. The third one is systemic skills. And the fourth one is judgmental skills. And we'll kind of review that. The intrapersonal skills. This is the ability to understand personal emotions and use that understanding to develop self-discipline, self-control, and learn from experience. How do young people learn how to process their own personal emotions? You ever gone through a difficult time without somebody to guide you? How do young people learn how to cope with their kids leaving home? How do we prepare them for transition or crisis management? If you look at the intrapersonal skills, it's basically people of maturity teaching people who are maturing how to deal with the person that is you. And sometimes we get so egocentric and so wrapped up in our own world that we fail to look very far. And our society is a very me society. Our society is all about us. And a lot of times we think that my personal understanding of things is accuracy. I'm about to lose my mind with all the bullying stuff that's happening. Do you know your words only have the power I give them? Plain and simple. There's nothing you can say that affects me unless I let it affect me. Romans chapter 1, verse 16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God to salvation to everyone who, what? Believes. If you don't believe the Word of God, it doesn't have any effect in your life. Well, if God's Word is limited by whether or not I buy into it, your words are limited too. But so, oh, they don't like me, I'm unlikable. They said a cruel thing about me, it must be bad. When you can model to people, you know, sometimes you have to live a life based on your personal integrity, regardless of how other people respond to it. How are the young people in this very soft society of ours going to learn that? You know, it's interesting that in World War II, 18-year-olds stormed the beach at Normandy, and now they need a safe place at college. Our 18-year-olds could spend some time with some of the folks from that generation and learn some things about value. And we think we have to have a house with 3,900 cable channels that we can't watch at the same time. And some folks lived in houses without electricity. If we'd really taught them how to deal with understanding of our own emotions and learn some self-discipline, learn some self-control, and learn that, hey, I did this way, it probably didn't work. Let me try again. And who's going to model that for this generation if it's not us? If they use themselves as a model, they end up with bad models. Does that make sense? Does that give you a sense of your mission in the church? Second thing is we talk about interpersonal skills. Interpersonal skills end up as allowing the individual to work with others and develop friendships through cooperation, communication, negotiation, sharing, empathizing, and listening. Intrapersonal skills and interpersonal skills is when the me that's me runs into the you that's you. And how many times have you recognized that me and you are different? There have been a lot of stuff written about the difference in guys and girls. Duh. Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. I mean, you know, from the beginning, God said they're two different. Well, sometimes I get into a situation and I think it's just my perspective, but when I have to deal with your perspective, that's different. And so learning that when we run into each other, number one, we develop friendships. Now, how do you develop friendships? Communication. Communication is not me making you understand me, but me trying to understand you. Most of the things I deal with as a therapist, when couples come in and they say, we're not communicating, what she says is, I can't make him see my point. And it's not your job. You're supposed to try to see his point. Because if I'm standing over here yelling, understand me, and she's saying, no, understand me, no, understand me, no, understand me, no, we're competing. When I say, well, let me make sure I know what you said. Let me make sure I understand what you feel. Let me make sure I see how important this is to you. When I bridge that gap, you try to bridge that other gap. And when I attempt to see the world from your perspective, as you would that men would do to you, do you also unto them. Jesus said, put yourself in other people's shoes and think, how would I like to be treated if I were there? When we can teach that skill to a younger generation, and then after we learn to communicate, we cooperate, negotiate, share, and empathize. Again, that's teaching people that your view of the world is not the only view of the world. Everybody you meet knows something you don't know and can see something you can't see. In 1996, I got involved with a project to go to Iowa and help them with flood relief. The Flint River, the Raccoon River had gotten out and flooded the Des Moines area. And we went out there with a team. We delivered 70,000 pounds of sheetrock by hand and two tractor-trailer truckloads of mattresses. And we'd go knock on doors, take a survey of what they needed, and they'd tell us and they'd laugh. Well, we need sheetrock. And the next day, they were crying when we showed up with the sheetrock. But I took four teenage boys with me, and guys that I had rock climbed with. You know what there is to rock climb in Iowa? Grain silos. Iowa is the flattest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's flatter than a new bride's pancakes. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. There's nothing out there to climb. Well, we were out there in Iowa, and we were talking some about climbing, and one of the guys who lived out there was a tree surgeon. He goes, oh, you guys climb rocks. I climb trees. I climbed trees when I was 8. Okay? He used these big Hauser-laid ropes. We use these real thin nylon ropes. Most of our gear is aluminum. All his gear was steel. He called his climbing harness a saddle. You put a saddle on a horse. You don't put a saddle on a tree. And he was a nice enough guy. But hey, we were cool rock climbers, and we really didn't give him a lot of time. He'd sit down with us and try to talk about something he used. Yeah, whatever. 2 years later, I built my first ropes course. I built that course on Keel Mountain, and we built it in some very tall hickory trees. You know what kind of equipment I had to learn to use to build that ropes course in those hickory trees? You know what I'd give for another hour with the tree surgeon? To sit down and say, show me that knot. Teach me that foot lock. If you get into my toolbox on my truck and you pull out my work harness, it's got tactical gear. It's got high industry, high angle gear, and it's got tree cutting gear. In fact, I use the tree cutting equipment more than I use anything else in my stable of equipment. If I'd have just sat down and listened to that guy about what he had to share with me, well, I'd have been a different guy. And sometimes kids miss these opportunities. They don't even know they're missing them. Be careful to try to do some of that to help some young people understand some things that they're missing. After the interpersonal skills, you have systemic skills. Systemic skills give us the ability to reason and respond to the limits and consequences of everyday life with responsibility, adaptability, flexibility, and integrity. When you have limits and consequences of life, that's where your wisdom comes from. You know, what you thought was a tragedy when you were 30, you look back on it now and see what a valuable lesson it was. When you had to start over at a business, or you lost a job, or had to move, or lost a child, and all the things that are really just part of life, they're part of life having limits and life having consequences, and learning that we have a responsibility for how we respond, not a victim mentality. We learn sometimes to have adaptability. Things turn out best for the people who make the best of the way things turn out. And you guys are masters of that because you've lived life. And life's not about being easy or fun or convenient. but it's about integrity. That when we have to choose between what's easy, fun, right, convenient, we're always going to choose what's right. And how does our younger generation learn that if we don't model that or spend some time? You know what it would take, due to a young man who's struggling in his business, for you to sit down and say, you know, I made a career change when I was your age because they violated my Christian principles. I was speaking in Evansville, Indiana. A young man invited me to come out and speak the opening weekend of bow season. I said, that's blasphemous. I said, it's bow season in Alabama. I usually don't travel during hunting season in Alabama. And the guy said, we hunt in Indiana. He said, I'd probably hook you up with somebody who'd take you hunting. I said, done. So I drove out there, got there a day or two early, and they let me hunt with this old gentleman. He'd hunted the same piece of property for 45 years. You think he didn't have some wisdom? And he said, well, since you're going to be hunting with me, instead of us losing valuable hunting time picking you up, why don't you just stay at my house? Very small house, smaller than my parents' house, and we were very poor growing up. My dad worked at a dairy. My mom didn't work till we were a little older. My mom is crippled in both her feet. She has club feet. One foot is shorter than the other, and we just, you know, we got by and we did what we were supposed to do. But you know, I didn't really realize we were poor till I was in college. But this was smaller than that house. But the old gentleman was gracious. An excellent woodsman. We spent two or three good days in the woods. And he said, you know, he said, I went to church with my wife for years and wasn't a Christian. He said, one Wednesday night I decided it was just time to become a Christian. He said, I walked down the aisle and was baptized. He said, the next morning I quit my job at the brewery. He said, I couldn't be a Christian and brew that stuff. And that decision locked him into that little bitty house his entire life. His two sons were raised in that house. His grandchildren have come and visited at that house. That one conversation about whether or not you want to be rich or want to be right, pretty significant impact. And I know his boys, and I don't know very many men I respect more than his two sons. And I know now why they're the caliber of men they are. And he shared that story with me about responding to life with integrity. And he said, I couldn't send my boys a message. I can go to church on Sunday and make beer during the week. And I think there's a lot of people who rash, well, I'm not drinking it. Well, I'm not necessarily selling it. But he made a decision based on integrity. What would happen if a young family heard the stories that you have to tell about what you had to decide to do to be a Christian, to keep your marriage together, to be honest and honorable in the community? You know, sometimes our younger generation thinks they have crisis and problems, and they really don't have crisis and problems. And a little perspective from some of us would help them. And then you have judgmental skills. The judgmental skills are basically the ability to use wisdom and evaluate situations according to appropriate values. That's basically, are we teaching our young people to make decisions on a biblical model? Hebrews chapter 5, the last part of it says that people who are mature have trained their senses to exercise the discernment between good and evil. When we teach our young people how to make good decisions, and those decisions are evaluated about what is good versus evil, you know, basically, I mean to go there, basically it's about values. And so many times the younger generation thinks about rules. Well, we didn't have a lot of rules in our house. We taught about honesty. We taught about purity. We thought about modesty. We thought about integrity. And so I didn't have to prove to my daughter or to the young people that anything was wrong. I said, are you an honest person? Yes. Can you say that and be honest? Can you cheat on that test and be honest? Can you fill out that form that way and be honest? Are you a person of purity? Can you drink that, smoke that, read that, watch that, listen to that, and still be pure? And if not, it goes away. And so instead of me having to prove what's right with this or what's wrong with it, does this fit our values? And when we model that Christianity is something that you are, rather than just something that you do, Christianity becomes something very, very different. I don't want this to be a teaching principle, and I don't know that it's that great of a thing, but I had a young man talk to me about really, really being upset that his daughter was dating a guy, and the young man was not a member of the church. I think it's very important that our children marry Christians. But I knew the situation where they were at, and I knew some of the people that they went to church with. And I said, let me ask you a question. Had you rather your daughter marry the rich young ruler or Cornelius? Now, you do know the difference between the two, right? The rich young ruler would have been Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday, well, Sabbath, I guess. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, Bible Bowl, Leaders for Christ, Lads to Leaders, mission trip, campaign, summer camp, and he was as hollow as a chocolate bunny. And Cornelius didn't do any of that stuff, but his heart was right, and he was teachable and convertible. Live according to values or live according to rules. And I have come to find out in my years that some people who appear to be super Christians are superficial. Be very, very careful not to let what we do be how we evaluate people, but what we are dictates what we do. We call it doing versus being. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians 13. If you speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and you have wisdom and knowledge, and you have charity, and you understand prophecy, and you have all this faith, and you have all those things, and you don't do it because you have love, those things don't matter. And teaching our younger generation that values come first, and they see the values-based lifestyles that you have, and learn the integrity, you've got a valuable contribution to make to those young people. Now, just before we get to maybe some practical comments, I want you to notice this. If you sum all these things up, this is the significant seven in one slide. Self-discipline, self-control, communication, cooperation, negotiation, sharing, empathizing, listening, responsibility, adaptability, flexibility, integrity, wisdom, and appropriate values. That's a pretty decent list, isn't it? Which one of those things does not fit in that category? All the things Steve and Glenn talked about in developing mature people, God talked about 2,000 years before, and his list is shorter. You compare those two lists. That's spiritual maturity. That's what this room represents, is people with spiritual maturity. And if you can take that spiritual maturity, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, and the gentleness and the ability to control the self, and you could spend that time with a young family or a college kid or a teenager or a preteen and help them develop those things, what will you have done for the church? What will you have done for this local congregation? Because see, everything we've talked about in raising self-reliant children or spiritually self-reliant children, you know, man, you read it on Stephen Glenn's chart and you read his definition, you go, oh man, that's really good stuff. Well, the Apostle Paul, by inspiration, talked about it, and his list was, we make a kid's song out of it, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. The guy in the back was singing it. That's why you're in this room, because at your stage in life, you should have mastered these things and be able to model them and pass them on. Now, what's the point of it all? Maturity and independence. Spiritual self-reliance. You are witnesses, and God also, how devoutly, justly, and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe. And you know, and listen to what Paul said his function was, how we exhorted, comforted, and charged every one of you as a father does his own children. Your job with the young families in this congregation is to encourage, comfort, and urge them, to exhort them, to charge them and urge them like a father does his own children. Now, what are you urging them to do? That you walk worthy of God who calls you into His own kingdom and glory. You may have a multi-million dollar business, but if you don't walk worthy of God who calls you into His own kingdom and glory, you failed. You may get a Division I scholarship as an athlete, but if you don't walk worthy of God who calls you into His own kingdom and glory, you failed. And you have the ability and the talent and the time and the maturity and the influence to trickle that down to the generation that is behind you. And if you teach them that, they'll teach the next generation that, and the next generation. And then you've recreated a version of the Great Commission. The New Century Version says that we encouraged you, we urged you, we insisted that you live good lives for God who calls you into His own glorious kingdom. And the Contemporary English Version will say similar. This is our goal when we encourage and we comfort and we urge. When we teach, I'm capable, I'm significant, I can influence what happens to me. The interpersonal skills, the intrapersonal skills, the systemic skills, and the judgmental skills. If we pass that on to the generation behind us, they walk worthy of God who calls us into His own kingdom and glory. That we live good lives for God who calls us into His glorious kingdom, and we live in a way that would honor God. That's your contribution to the next generation. Now, 3 John 4 says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. Real values. And I know that we don't mean it when we say that, but we describe our students as, I've got an A student, and I've got a B student, or I've got a football player, or I've got a band kid. I dated a girl at Harding. She said, I've never made a B. I said, well, me neither. And we meant different stuff. We meant different stuff by it, okay? But what would happen if our children walked away and they said, I'm God's student, and I make A's, B's, or C's? I'm God's student, and I play football. I'm God's student, and I'm in the band. See, if you model a spiritual self-identity, the next generation learns to be spiritually self-reliant, because you've taught them that success in life is not about what you accomplish or what you build or what you buy or what you own. You've taught them that success in life is who you serve. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. And if you brag on the children for being at church and brag on the children for being a Christian example, and you brag on the children that you see for being a representative of God in their schools, you give them, I'm capable, I'm significant, and teach them that they're earning the praise of God as well as the praise of people by modeling the kind of life that we want them to have spiritual self-reliance and spiritual maturity. And you can't learn spiritual maturity from immature spiritual people. They can only learn spiritual maturity from the spiritually mature. That not just the kids, but their parents as well. Does that make some kind of sense? Now, is there questions or comments or anything before I hush? I know it's been a long path to get here, but you've got a very important job to do as the mature people in this congregation. It's not time to retire. It's not time to stop. It's not time to quit. It's time to mentor. And you guys could create a mentoring program where you just say, every year we're going to assign a teenager to this couple. We're going to assign this couple to this family and spend just 1 year interacting with them. Go to one ball game a year. Invite them out to dinner. Let them come to your anniversary. Go to little Susie's first grade graduation and get involved. And you don't have to, it's not a lifetime commitment. Just one or two families here and there throughout the years. And at some point, you'll meet somebody that needs what you can offer and is asking you for what they need. And this is not about sending their kids to college or getting involved with them financially. This is simply about being a role model and an influence with your wisdom, your integrity, and your maturity. Attention, belonging, support, encourage, comfort, urge. I told you you'd hear that a lot. Well, we've said it again. Any questions or comments? All right, I'm going to turn it back over to somebody who's in charge. Thank you.